I'm Indy Todd, host of The Point. Today we discuss breast cancer. According to the National Cancer Institute, after skin cancer, breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among American women. Approximately 1 in 8 American women will develop invasive breast cancer over the course of her lifetime. A National Institutes of Health report notes that only 10 to 16% of women diagnosed with breast cancer have a first-degree relative with a history of the disease, leaving environmental factors and lifestyle choices as other potential causes. Joining us to talk about breast cancer here in Woods Hole, Dr. Peter Hopewood, who's a cancer surgeon. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Dr. Julia Brody, Executive Director of Silent Spring Institute, is joining us from our studio in Boston. Good morning, Dr. Brody.
Hello.
Hi. Well, breast cancer and genetic testing for breast cancer made headlines recently when actress Angelina Jolie revealed her decision to undergo a double mastectomy, not because she had breast cancer, but because genetic testing showed she carries a defective gene that put her at a high risk for developing breast cancer. So, Dr. Hopewood, let's start talking about genetic testing. Can you explain what these tests are looking for and who should be tested?
So there's a group of people that are born with a defective gene, and they've inherited this from their parents. And this gene is the BRCA gene, or breast cancer gene. And that gene is been amplified in certain populations over the last hundreds of years. And those populations were amplified because the peoples of these cultures were isolated from other cultures, so there was a lot of inbreeding among the families. So you'd be marrying cousins or second cousins. So Ashkenazi Jewish people, for example, Icelandics, people from Samoa, from Crete, Romania, French Canadians. A lot of these people were politically isolated, you know, put in ghettos, and they really had very little chance to leave these areas. So they intermarried. And these genes that were very, very rare would start to appear more and more commonly among the offsprings. Mm-hmm. And then these genes then have a high risk of having mutations, which can increase the risk of developing breast cancer or ovarian cancer and sometimes pancreatic cancer. So when we talk to a woman, we see somebody in the office that has some concern about having inherited this gene from a parent, we ask a family history. So there's certain red flags or warning that we get very concerned about. It would be a woman developing breast cancer at a young age, under the age of 50, a woman who's has first-degree relatives that have had breast cancer or ovarian cancer. So a first-degree relative is either your parent, your siblings, or one of your children. And this also includes men now, because men can also get breast cancer. A man that has breast cancer would be automatically considered at a risk for inheriting that gene from his parent. Mm. So we have young age. We have more than one first-degree relative with breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And then we have having multiple cancers. And so if a woman had said, I have had, you know, colon cancer in the past, and now I have a breast cancer, it's more than one cancer. Something's wrong with the gene pool in that person.
Right. So now, in Angelina Jolie's case, I guess her risk was very high. So that's why she made this decision. But not everybody is, even if you have the genetic testing, even if you have that gene, you're not everyone is a candidate for a double mastectomy, right?
Well, if you inherit the gene, then you have, depending, there's two different BRCA genes, but the average risk is about 60, 70% of getting breast cancer in your mm-hmm. lifetime. Mm-hmm. And it could be up to 40 or 50% for developing mm-hmm. ovarian cancer. If you don't have that gene, you don't get it later. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the gene, you can't give it to your children.
Gotcha.
And the gene is what we call autonomic dominant. It's a flip of a coin if you inherit it or not.
So your sister might have it and you're not.
That's right. Your mother might have it and then I might not mm-hmm. or my sister might.
Right.
But if I don't have it, I can't give it to my children.
Right.
So it does. So it's
worth
ends.
Getting the testing. If you have a family history of this, it's worth getting testing just to know who's got the gene and who doesn't.
Right. And they'll have sort of a score sheet. They'll ask those questions. You know, has anybody in your family had breast cancer? What were their ages? Mm-hmm. What's your ancestry? How about ovarian cancer? Any other cancer? They do a family tree.
Right.
And the testing is very simple. It's either a mouthwash. They look for exfoliated cells from your buccal mucosa mm-hmm. or a blood test.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes about 2 weeks to get the result back.
And then sometimes women get this testing after a diagnosis of breast cancer. So what's the advantage of testing after you have a diagnosis?
Well, if you have a diagnosis of breast cancer and have this test done, we try to do that testing before you have definitive surgery because it may impact exactly what you have done. Mm-hmm. So if I see somebody in the office who's been recently diagnosed with breast cancer and she tells me my mother had breast cancer and I have my mother's mother had breast cancer and I have a sister with breast cancer, then we would test that woman. We would try to hold off on doing any definitive surgery until we get the results back. It takes about 2 weeks. But even though the testing takes 2 weeks, we have to go through the insurance carriers because the insurance carriers will want to approve this. And the test is about $3,000.
And so is it covered by insurance?
It is covered by insurance, but we have to jump through a few hoops. Medicare is a little easier than the other insurers. But a lot of times we get on the phone with the insurers saying, here's the history. And then if the insurers will not cover it, we present this to the patient. They will still treat them for the breast cancer. But if you have that genetic mutation, then you can be treated for the breast cancer we just found. But the risk of developing another breast cancer is very high.
Right. We're talking about breast cancer. If you have questions about genetic testing or breast cancer in general, 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Dr. Brody, Silent Spring was it 1993, I believe, discovered that there were 11 of the 15 towns here on the Cape where women had about a 15% greater risk of breast cancer or incident of breast cancer than the rest of the state. Talk a little bit about, generically, some of the research, what you've been finding. We'll get into some more specifics a little bit later on.
Yes, when the state first calculated breast cancer incidence by town, it was stunning to see that nearly all the towns on Cape Cod had higher breast cancer incidence than the rest of the state. And Cape Cod women and leaders of the Massachusetts Breast Cancer Coalition got together and said, we need to find out why, because this is an indication that maybe something is going on here. And they founded Silent Spring Institute to pursue understanding of environmental factors in breast cancer with a goal of figuring out how to prevent the disease. I think we've seen so clearly with Angelina Jolie's courageous decision to talk about her own situation that the choices for women dealing with breast cancer right now are not very good. And it's thought-provoking to think that even among women who have this high-risk inherited gene, not all of them get breast cancer, so there's something else going on. And indeed, as we've already discussed, most breast cancer is not due to inherited genes. So on Cape Cod, we began exploring the possibility that chemicals in the environment, chemicals that might be breast carcinogens or chemicals that might be hormone disruptors, might be contributing to higher incidence on Cape Cod as well as elsewhere.
Now, in the news this week, there was some research showing that gene mutations in African-American women may be responsible for more breast cancer cases than previously thought. Does race and ethnicity play a role in the breast cancer risk? I mean, you just mentioned some, you know, the Icelandic and, you know, folks that might have this gene. But in general, does race play a role?
Well, when you look at the global map of the entire globe, the highest incidence of breast cancer is in the developed world. It's North America. It's Western Europe and Australia. And when you think of the lineages, the ancestries there, we're talking about white Caucasians, basically. And then we find that when you look at a map of the United States, for incidence, we're finding that it's really a scattergram. It's the high incidence in sort of in the Washington, Oregon area, and then again up in the middle Atlantic states in the Northeast. When you look at the state of Massachusetts, for incidence, we find a very high incidence in breast cancer in Essex County, in Middlesex County, Norfolk County, and Duke County. And then that's soon followed by Barnstable County.
So the U.S. and U.K. have the highest incidence rates of breast cancer worldwide. And we're reading when a woman from Japan moves to the U.S., her risk of breast cancer increases. Do we know why that is? Is it just the lifestyle?
Well, that's one of the great research questions right now. We're seeing incidence rising in the countries that are industrializing worldwide. So incidence is rising in China and Africa. And we have seen historically that when women move from a low-risk country, like in Asia, to a high-risk place like the U.S., their risk goes up, and their granddaughter's risk increases again. The State of California Breast Cancer Research Program, where, of course, there's a very diverse population, has made this a central focus of their research focused on trying to identify opportunities for prevention. One thing we do know about breast cancer is that there are multiple factors involved, some including things that you can't modify very easily, like how old you are when you have your kids, and some that you can change, like increasing physical activity. But there's a great deal of breast cancer risk that hasn't been explained, and that's where Silent Spring Institute is trying to identify additional risk factors. And in the past 3 years, in fact, there have been three important authoritative statements, most recently by the Institute of Medicine and then by a federal interagency committee, saying that there's an enormous opportunity to reduce the cancer burden by addressing prevention. And I just want to take a minute to thank the women on Cape Cod who participated in the Cape Cod Breast Cancer Environment Study over the past 20 years, because we have been among the major contributors to developing this new consensus that prevention is a real opportunity. They cited 11 Silent Spring Institute studies in the most recent report.
And those studies are really interesting, what you're saying, where you went into these homes of these women and you measured all kinds of things. You know, you were looking at what chemicals like pesticides, consumer products, drugs. You were looking at all of those things?
We did measure 89 different hormone disruptors in Cape Cod homes. Hormone disruptors are chemicals that could affect your natural hormone signaling system, including mimicking estrogen. We know that estrogen can make breast cancer cells grow in a lab, and that lifetime estrogen exposure is a breast cancer risk factor. So we looked at chemicals that are very common in everyday products, like detergents and cosmetics and pesticides, plastics. And this is actually the most comprehensive study anywhere of hormone disruptors in homes. So it's been a very important piece of evidence that shows that consumer products actually are a major source of exposure to these hormone disruptors. Mm-hmm. We've also tested drinking water on Cape Cod because the Cape's vulnerable drinking water supplies can easily become contaminated from septic system wastes. So that's also been an area where we have found that there's a potential for exposure to these chemicals that are biologically linked to breast cancer.
One of the problems, it's like a needle in a haystack, though, isn't it, in a lot of cases? I mean, you have these certain chemicals you're testing for, but we're not testing for everything. So we don't know what else might be there, right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So one of the things that we're trying to develop for the future is ways to measure total estrogenicity, so you're not just measuring one chemical at a time.
Right. Dr. Hopper, what are some of the other risk factors? You know, we're talking about it's tough for us to kind of evaluate our homes. I guess we have to think twice about what we're buying. But you know, as far as lifestyle choices, what increases our risk?
Well, I think Julia talked about the estrogen effect, and there's a term called the estrogen window, and that means you're cumulative exposure to estrogen during your lifetime. So an estrogen window opens when you start having menstrual periods. It closes at menopause. So you think of the number of years between having menarche, starting your menstrual periods, and menopause. And then during pregnancy, your estrogen window closes, even though you'd think you have lots of estrogen. So more pregnancies decreases your estrogen window opening. And then if you take hormone replacement therapy at menopause for menopausal symptoms, your window stays open longer because you're adding estrogen to your body. So you have the estrogen window effect, so cumulative estrogen effect. Now, we know that obesity for people will increase estrogen building blocks in your body. So that will increase estrogen exposure and also alcohol intake. The latest studies are saying if you drink more than 5 or 6 beverages a week, cumulative a week, it seems to increase the incidence of breast cancer. So we have obesity, we have alcohol intake, and then we have lifestyle. Exercise is the third one. So those are the things, that behavioral changes that can be done to decrease your risk for developing breast cancer.
I just want to go to the exercise for a second, because there's a woman at my gym who is a cancer survivor, and she said her oncologist told her one of the best things that she can do going forward is exercise.
You know, exercise is sort of a codependent variable with obesity. If you exercise, and then you're less likely to be obese.
Yeah. Okay.
And obesity, once again, increases the risk of breast cancer.
Right. So, and when we say exercise, does this mean just like walking? Does it mean you joining a gym? And what kind of exercise are we talking about?
Well, I think you're talking about 20, 30 minutes of a sweat, you know, mm-hmm. Walking hard and getting sweaty and doing that at least 3 to 5 times a week.
So you don't have to be lifting weights or anything.
That's right.
But that's good for your bones.
That's good for your bones and your muscles.
There we go. All right. We are talking about breast cancer with Dr. Peter Hopewood, cancer surgeon, and Dr. Julia Brody, executive director of Silent Spring Institute. We'll talk more right after a break.
Lobsterman George Cadwallader from Woods Hole.
His name was Buck after a collie I had as a boy. Buck and the coyotes used to watch each other. And they were very similar. He was a short-haired dog, short-haired border collie, long, kind of rangy build. And the local coyotes are built very much the same way. They're quite pretty animals. He was a border collie, and if anything he saw moving around, he had to herd it. If it didn't go where he wanted it to, he'd nip at it. He didn't mean any harm. He was a wonderful boat dog. He sometimes in the fog could spot my floats before I saw him. That was his station right there. And his nose was like a radar. You just watch where he was looking, and chances are he had a pot. Actually, you could make a case for the fact that we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Buck. I was going across the Sound in a very thick fog. And there's a radar that normally sits here. And I had a big target on the radar. And all of a sudden, about half a mile out, it just disappeared. It just fell off the screen. And so I was sort of fiddling, trying to tune it back in. And all of a sudden, he began to bark. And I looked up, and right in front of me was this big dragger, had his flopper stoppers out. And the buck hadn't barked, it'd run us right over.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about breast cancer with Dr. Peter Hopewood, cancer surgeon, and Dr. Julia Brody, executive director of Silent Spring Institute. Dr. Brody, we were talking about some of the chemicals and things that you were looking at in people's homes, and when you consider all the chemicals we come into contact with every day. You know, we have pesticides in our foods, chemicals in the fabrics of, you know, our cars, you know, our homes, our shampoo. And then when you think about these chemicals in combination with one another, this could pose an entirely different risk. I kind of go back to that needle in the haystack. How do you even begin to assess the health risks of these chemicals?
Well, we have to make a start with first looking at what they do in the lab biologically. So one of the things that we've been working on is testing chemicals to see if they have the same fingerprint as other chemicals that have been shown to cause breast cancers in animal studies. We can also look in the lab to see which ones mimic estrogen and make human breast cancer cells grow. We were talking earlier about windows of exposure, and we're also focused on a very early life window of exposure before birth, when the breast is just beginning to develop, which we're learning can affect breast cancer risk later on. So for one thing, we look to see which are the chemicals that we should worry about. And then we look in the environment to see which ones are we most exposed to. And that's also been a core area of our research. Once we have those two pieces of information, we can begin thinking about ways to reduce exposure and avoid those chemicals by reformulating products or not using certain products. There's protections in some states, including Massachusetts, where we have the Toxic Use Reduction Act, and in California, that try to look at chemicals before they go into products and start reducing the use of the ones that are worrisome. We don't have as good protections here in the U.S. as they have in Europe, where there's a program called REACH that really is beginning to require chemical testing for chemicals before they go into use. I think it's kind of shocking to realize that in the U.S. we really don't test chemicals before we put them into products. But that would be a step that we could take.
Yeah. Let's talk to Diane, who's giving us a call from East Dennis. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
I have a very strong family history of breast cancer, starting with my maternal and paternal grandmothers. My mother died of breast cancer. My two sisters, who are older than me, have both had breast cancer. So I'm being treated at the high-risk breast cancer center at UMass Medical in Worcester. And one of the things I'm going to do is have a meeting with a geneticist to talk about getting tested for the gene. Mm-hmm. Both of my sisters tested negative, but I'm probably going to undergo the test. But I'm also asking about the use of Evista. I am on Evista, 60 milligrams, and I'm just wondering what the thought process is by the doctors on taking Evista as a preventative measure.
Tell us what Evista is, Dr. Hopewood, first.
So Evista is an estrogen blocker, and it's a selective estrogen modulator, and it will block the estrogen from getting into cells. Mm-hmm. Evista has about 40% a reduction in breast cancer risk. So it can be used as a preventive agent. Also, tamoxifen is the other drug used for preventive agents. Mm-hmm. But Evista has a nice effect, as does tamoxifen, in increasing bone strength. So a lot of gynecologists had put their patients on Evista for preventing osteoporosis, mm-hmm. but also decreasing the risk of breast cancer.
Right. Yeah, and Diane, it sounds like a good idea to have that genetic testing done.
Yes, I think so too.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Good luck with that, with your test. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Here's a case where she said, you know, both of her sisters tested negative, but that she could be the one that has the gene.
That's right, especially if her mother had it and her grandmother on that side. So once again, that testing could be a mouthwash looking for the cells that come from your mucosa inside your mm-hmm. cheeks, mm-hmm. or it could be a blood test. It takes about 2 weeks to come back. There's only one laboratory in the whole United States that does these tests.
Going back to Angelina Jolie for a second, Dr. Brody, you had mentioned her courageous decision. I agree. I think for her, a celebrity of her status, to come out and talk about this, she didn't have to tell the public what was happening with her. And it really has raised awareness for a lot of folks. I imagine, Dr. Hopewood, you're getting some phone calls from some of your patients as they're reading some of this news. A lot of people are saying, wait, maybe I need to get this test.
Well, it's important to realize that having the mastectomies is a medical decision. Mm-hmm. You know, we would recommend for her to have those that operation at a time of her life when she's, you know, that's right for her, and that's usually done by the time they're 40 because mm-hmm. the risk of breast cancer is at young age in that population with that mutation, and then after childbearing, we would tell them to have their ovaries out at the same time.
Yeah. All right, Dan is giving us a call from Barnstable. Hi, Dan.
Hi, I wanted to ask your panelists to answer two questions. One, what is the implication of birth control pill usage? And two, do any of the studies include the presence of female pets in the home?
Of a female what?
Female pets.
Pets, okay.
Well, the birth control pills have estrogen in them, so that'll increase your estrogen exposure. So there's a slight increase with the use of birth control pills. At the same time, birth control pills decrease your ability to be pregnant, and we said that being pregnant decreases your estrogen exposure. So the window closes when you're pregnant, so birth control pills then don't let you become pregnant, so your window's open, and then some birth control pills will have estrogens in them. So they'll mm-hmm. slightly increase the risk.
Right. As far as the research into female pets, Dr. Brody, do you know of anything?
I don't. And I just want to add on the birth control, because, of course, women need to make decisions that work for their life. Mm-hmm. And once you go off birth control pills, the research shows that your breast cancer risk goes back down. So it's sometimes women may make a decision to use them in their younger years, and then as their breast cancer risk rises, they are going off the pill, and their risk is the risk from that goes down.
Okay. Dan, thanks for the call. Joanne is calling from South Yarmouth. Hi, Joanne.
Well, hi there. Good morning. I enjoy this very timely and important discussion. But throughout the discussion, I have not heard too much about the role nutrition plays. Mm-hmm. I'm an instructor for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in D.C., and I do food for life nutrition and cooking classes for cancer prevention and survival here on the Cape and throughout southeastern Massachusetts. And what I find is that we can talk about, you know, drugs, we can talk about, you know, prophylactic treatments and surgeries, which all have their place. But if the public understood the role that nutrition plays, mm-hmm. and the standard American diet, which is very high in fat and very devoid in fiber, plays a key role mm-hmm. in those hormone-related cancers. By keeping those estrogen and those testosterone levels in men high, people have to be educated about how foods impact health. So I would like to hear some discussion on that this morning, in addition to the other factors that yeah. you're talking about that can mitigate.
Joanne, hang on. Don't hang up. That's a good point she's bringing up. Nutrition is very important.
It's very important, and I think nutrition goes hand in hand with the obesity. And healthy eating, you can still be overweight because you increased your carbohydrate intake or your total caloric intake, but your food choices are very important. We've seen that in cardiac disease, replacing animal fats with vegetable fats or with fish oils and fish fats like that. So that's very, very important for overall health. And once again, it's exercise, it's lifestyle choices, and it's weight control.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, since you have some expertise here, I wanted to ask you some thoughts on this. You know, we look at that food pyramid, which seems to change quite a bit. And I think for some people, it's really hard to figure out, just what exactly is the right food. So how do you advise people?
Basically, we teach about whole foods, plant-based. If people can really create a lifestyle where they're consuming more of whole foods, plant-based, eating more of the cruciferous vegetables, the grains, the legumes, which give you healthy sources of protein and lots of fiber, you're really going to reduce your risk of a lot of chronic illnesses. And I cannot tell you the number of women who come to my classes, who have shared stories. One in particular, one of our instructors, metastatic breast cancer. She had two types of cancer, Meg Wolf up in Portland, Maine, who is now totally cancer-free by changing her nutrition. Ruth Heidrich out in California, who's now in her 70s, was diagnosed at 47 with metastatic breast cancer, went to her lung, went to her bones. She's alive and well today. Mm-hmm. I think the word has to get out to the American public that they can take some control of their health by being very careful consumers, educating themselves as to the power of foods to heal, and learn how to shop to buy those healthy foods.
All right. Yeah, Joanne, thanks for that. And we had a nutritionist on not too long ago, and one of the things she was saying is when you're shopping, shop around the perimeter in the grocery store. Right. All that processed stuff is in the middle of the store.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If I could make one quick comment,
go ahead.
Kaiser Permanente, which is one of the biggest managed healthcare programs in the country, they just came out with a paper written by three of their doctors and a nutritionist for physicians, advising physicians to teach and to teach their patients about plant-based nutrition as a way of healing. So that's big. That's big news, and that needs to be brought to the public's attention.
All right, Joanne, thanks for calling in this morning. We appreciate your information there.
Joanne's comment about nutrition, it has a lot to do with your immune system, mm-hmm. and you are what you eat. To paraphrase someone, and a lot of times you can affect your immune system by the foods you eat, mm-hmm. and we know that some diets are more immunogenic or will increase your immune system, and this includes antioxidants, the brassica family, the leafy vegetables, mm-hmm. the root vegetables that are orange.
Well, the other thing, too, I've been shocked in just looking at this for my own sake, is the anti-inflammatory foods. I mean, so many foods that are cause inflammation that you wouldn't even think of. And so we really kind of figuring out what those anti-inflammatories are.
Exactly. There's things like flaxseed and tofu. These are all these herbal supplements. There's oil of evening primrose. Mm-hmm. These are all antioxidants. Mm-hmm. And they're probably good for you.
Blueberries.
Right.
Richard is giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
I am an advocate of reverse osmosis units in the home for people who have private wells, but I'm also aware that one of the municipal water supplies, I think it's in Dennis or Yarmouth, has been tested for emerging chemicals in their public water supply. And is there any any community on the Cape that was considering a community-wide reverse osmosis unit in the water treatment.
I don't know. Maybe Dr. Brody knows the answer to that.
I don't know what solutions are being considered specifically. Silent Spring Institute tested wells in 9 of the public water supplies and all across the Cape in 20 private wells. And we did find emerging contaminants in about 3/4 of the wells. We found things that are coming from septic systems leaching out into groundwater and then into drinking water wells. So, for example, we found antibiotics and mm-hmm. artificial sweeteners and perfluorinated compounds. Those are from non-stick and stain-resistant surfaces and some flame retardants. And this is very much a concern for us. We think it's very important for Cape Cod communities to plan for the future to protect their drinking water supplies, not just to protect the environment from the nitrate loading, but also to protect people mm-hmm. from being exposed to these kinds of contaminants. We've been planning some additional research to try to figure out exactly how these contaminants are traveling in the Cape Cod groundwater and what are the best ways to remove them and protect the drinking water supplies. We're actually quite worried. The legislature supported this work. The state legislature supported this work last year, and it's not in the budget for next year, so yeah. we're quite worried about
that. Dr. Brody, what about this reverse osmosis system? What are your thoughts on that?
There are that is one of the systems that can remove contaminants. A solid carbon block filter can also remove contaminants.
All right. Richard, thanks for the call. Gail is calling from Dennis. Hi, Gail.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Gail.
Hi. Yes, I'm a cancer survivor. I had breast cancer in 2004, and I started reading books and wanting more information, and the Silent Spring Institute was so helpful. I called, and they sent me a newsletter and a list of all of these contaminants that are in our household products and in the women are using creams, makeup. They're in all these chemicals are in many, many, many products mm-hmm. that women are taking into their bodies or, you know, putting on the surface, and then right. it goes in. So I have consciously made an effort to read labels and eliminate many, many products mm-hmm. and only go for the more the natural and that aren't as dangerous. But when I talk to girlfriends who have had cancer, women who, you know, I'm now 72, but when I talk to women, it's almost like they put a screen over their face. They don't really want to hear. It's this. We've got to get this information out more boldly, like in the press. I don't know, because they're not kind of believing. I think a lot of people think I'm overdoing it, you know. Mm-hmm. But I know I'm not.
Right. Yeah. Gail brings
that's
up
a real concern for me, for my loved ones, my right. daughter. My daughter actually does read a lot about mm-hmm. this, but. I don't know what can be done.
Right.
I think our country is just being, and I know there's a lot of control from the lobbyists and yeah. the chemical companies, the big chemical companies.
Well, Gail, you're bringing up a good point, and Dr. Brody, I think you can probably speak to this, is educating yourself about what's in these products. And I'm sure the information that Silent Spring sent out to Gail is certainly available to anyone, right?
Yes, it's wonderful to hear that was helpful. And anyone who wants to look for this kind of information, it's on our website at silentspring.org. If you look on the homepage, there's a tab called Take Action, mm-hmm. and you'll see a lot of tips for things that you can do as an individual and ways to get involved in your community and nationally in changing policies that are creating chemical exposures.
We're talking about breast cancer with Dr. Julia Brody, Executive Director of Silent Spring Institute, and Dr. Peter Hopewood, a cancer surgeon. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. We'll talk more after a break.
I thought it would be a little more impressive, I must say. I thought it would be like more in the water sort of thing.
A lot smaller than I imagined. A lot smaller.
It's smaller than we thought?
It's smaller than I thought it would be.
It's just a little small rock.
Summer visitors at Plymouth Rock.
I thought it was like a pointy rock, you know, out in the middle of the water or something. You know.
It's not as big as other rocks in the area. About 4 guys could pick this thing up.
Would love to have been a fly on the wall at the Mayflower when they pulled in here.
I said, look at that rock.
It's like, let's get out of this boat and settle here and name the town after that rock.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
I actually expected something a whole lot more spectacular. I'm like, where's Plymouth Rock? I'm like, okay, this is it.
When Jim Stickley talks his way into a bank, he's not looking for cash. He wants to tap into the bank's data.
Because if I can gain access to every one of your customers' accounts, which means social security numbers, mother's maiden names, credit card numbers, all of that, I mean, that's the end-all be-all.
Coming up on the story, the work of a hired hacker, a man who is paid by the banks to show them where they're vulnerable.
Join us for the story tonight at 10 here on WCAI.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about breast cancer with Dr. Peter Hopewood, cancer surgeon, and Dr. Julia Brody, executive director of Silent Spring Institute. Our toll-free number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Dr. Hopewood, technology for mammograms has changed in recent years. Are we getting better information now? I mean, is it easier to diagnose? And I want to talk a little about treatment options as well.
Well, the mammograms have changed. It used to be film mammography, which, the standard, everybody looks at an x-ray, you see this black thing, you put it up on a view box, and now they're digitized. So the first thing about being digitized is that the storage is electronic, so they're very portable. You can have a disk, you can have a memory stick with your mammograms, you can have a memory stick with your whole health record, and which probably is along the way put in your car key or something like that and take it with you wherever you go. And so the digital mammograms are better for younger women because it has a little better chance of looking through dense breast tissue. And the younger a woman's breast is, the more dense it becomes. So that's one of the reasons they don't recommend routine mammograms under the age of 40, because it really looks like a snowstorm. And the best way to think of it is if you have a clear sky with very few clouds, you see a bird going through it, that would be a breast that has very, very low density, doesn't have a lot of clouds, it's a fatty breast. That would be an older breast. A woman after menopause or an older age that has a very clear-looking breast. So if there's anything in that breast, the mammogram will pick it up. If you think of a dense breast, this would be a woman, now younger woman. It could also be an older woman with dense breast tissue. It's like having a cloudy sky. You could have a bird flying through the middle of that sky. You could have a plane. And you will not see it. Mm. So mammography, that's one of the caveats with mammography, and that's when you might get your mammogram report, mailed to you from the radiologist, says that mammography doesn't pick up all things because it can miss things in dense breast tissue.
Right. And then we've had some argue that the false positives from mammograms have resulted in many unnecessary biopsies and unnecessary testing. Is that still the case?
Well, there's this what we call the callback rate. So you have a screening mammogram and they see something, they just really don't know what it is. So they ask you to come back to have diagnostic films. That means the same mammogram with maybe two or three different views, different compression, and then maybe add an ultrasound to that. At that point, you're getting a little sweaty, you're starting to get a little bit scratchy on the chalkboard. And then if you have to go back then for further studies, for a biopsy, you're climbing the wall, because at that point, you're almost sure you're going to have a malignant diagnosis. The majority of these are going to be benign, but they really want to find them early. They don't want to let these things progress.
All right. What about men? We don't, and we mentioned men can also get breast cancer. Risk maybe not as great, but I don't hear about men getting mammographies, though.
Well, men don't get mammography unless they have a breast symptom, and usually it's breast growth. And the thing called gynecomastia, which is breast enlargement in a man's very common to have breast enlargement during puberty. So you'll have a 12 to 15-year-old boy who's going through the sexual changes. He's starting to make a lot of androgen. And he has unbalanced estrogen and androgen levels in his body. So his breast will develop. And then they usually just start to smooth out as they get older. But sometimes they don't, or sometimes it develops later in life. And that can be related to medications. A lot of times it's medication-related. There's a lot of drugs that will change the estrogen-androgen balance in your body that will cause breast enlargement. So then those men will get a mammogram.
Right. So for men, should men be doing self-exams? Like, we're always telling women do self-exams. How do men know if, you know, if they've got some...
Well, I think it's basically if you have a, you know, a painful lump or a bump in your breast, you got to say, well, what's that? And, you know, I would say give it just 2-3 weeks. If it doesn't go away or persist, just ask your doctor to check it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of times women, you know, there's a lot of controversy about women performing self-examination. But I still think it's a good idea to at least know your body, know your breast, and don't, this is something different. This is something new going on. That is something you should, you know, get some help with. If it's something you've had all your life, you can leave it alone.
And what about different treatment options? Where are we as far as the technology and advancements in treatment?
Well, a treatment for breast cancer has come a long way. Back in the 60s and the 70s, we've gone from radical surgery to less and less radical surgery. We've gone from a thing called a radical mastectomy, where you would remove a breast, the muscles, and all the lymph nodes, to a modified radical operation, which would remove the breast but leave the muscles and remove the lymph nodes. Now we're down to a lumpectomy, where you're just taking the lump out and sampling a single lymph node or two. The newer trials out in Arkansas and other places are looking at doing your biopsy and then using a microwave coil or a radio frequency ablation and just cooking it, and then without having to have a lumpectomy. So as we learn more and more how to score these tumors and find their biology, how they're going to behave, then we need to take less and less out, because we're really depending on radiation, hormone treatments, or chemotherapy to prevent these things from coming back or new ones developing.
Right. We're talking about breast cancer. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Dr. Brody, much of the money spent on breast cancer has been in treatment, but recently there's been a call to focus more money on preventing breast cancer. Can you tell us more about the recommendations from the Interagency Breast Cancer and Environmental Research Coordinating Committee? That's a mouthful, isn't it? About breast cancer prevention.
Yes, this is a very important report that's a consensus statement by a large group that studied these issues and found there was an enormous opportunity to advance our understanding of prevention, which, of course, is the better answer for breast cancer. Although it's wonderful that treatments have improved, it's still an arduous process, and prevention would be a much better route to go. Right now, as you said, the enormous balance is towards research and expenditures on treatment. We're actually spending $17.5 billion a year on breast cancer treatment, and the research funding is unbalanced as well. So this report called for new funding to shift that balance so that we would be looking at the causes of breast cancer so that we can then change them. And one of the important points in this report is that we need to look across the entire life cycle. Breast cancer risks can begin even before a baby girl is born. We found that there are some chemicals where exposure to the mom, these are in animal studies, can affect the offspring's breast development in ways that make that animal permanently more susceptible to carcinogens when they're exposed later in life. So this report suggests shifting our resources to understand the development of risk beginning very early in life and then extending all the way up through the time near diagnosis when, for example, combined hormone therapies will increase breast cancer risk. It also talked about chemical safety and the need to focus on developing new technologies for chemical safety. And I mentioned earlier that that's an area where Silent Spring Institute is really focusing our research so that we can test chemicals before we put them into use and avoid using the ones that are going to increase breast cancer risk later on.
Another thought I just had as you're talking about this is, you know, sometimes it, going back to the food for a second, when you're reading the labels and some of the meat products, they're given hormones. And I'm wondering if we know how that impacts, especially young people as they're growing and, you know, they're maybe in their diet getting these extra hormones. Does that have an impact?
Well, that's a question that's just come up, actually. I'm on an advisory council of the California Breast Cancer Research Program. And we don't know the answer to that question yet. We don't really know a lot about how people are exposed to those hormones that are used in animals. So that's that's an example of a question that we need to pursue and that should be a priority.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the there's the study, the American Cancer Society has their cancer prevention studies, and they're running their third one now. The first study, they looked at the linkage between smoking and lung cancer. The second study was obesity and cancer. And the third one now is a longitudinal study. These are patients that never had cancer that you go in, they do your weight, your waistline. They look at your behaviors, your activities, your lifestyles, and they draw blood and they archive the blood. It's buried in somewhere in the Nevada desert, right, and frozen. And then in 10 or 20 years, then when we fill out these forms on an annual basis to find out what's happened to our health, and if, let's say they find a cluster of people have had breast cancer, they're all going to go back, pull the blood, and then they're going to study the blood to see if there's anything that links it. So that may go back to saying, well, what about cows that are given hormones to produce more milk, or mm-hmm. or animals that are given hormones so they can mature more quickly and, mm-hmm. and brought to slaughter?
Yeah, that was a fascinating.
So the new federal report is saying we need to go back even earlier in life. And there is one study that was able to do that. It's based in California at where they took samples from women who were giving birth at the Kaiser Center in Oakland in the late 1950s and 60s. And they stored it just the way Dr. Hopewood was talking about. And then now those women are old enough where some of them have been diagnosed with breast cancer. And they found that among women who had been exposed to DDT as girls younger than 14, the breast cancer risk later on was five times as high mm-hmm. as those who had lower levels of DDT in their blood back when they were in their 20s or mm-hmm. giving birth. This study is now recruiting the daughters of those women because we think we're beginning to see intergenerational effects. But this is the kind of research that we need to be supporting long term. On the other hand, we don't want to wait 60 years to find out that the chemicals we're using in shampoo or hand lotion right now cause breast cancer. So we need other strategies as well that use rapid laboratory screening methods mm-hmm. to find out those chemicals that are the bad bets right. for breast cancer risk.
I don't know if you know, Dr. Brody, much about the thermal effects, but Dr. Hopper, we were talking off the air about this. Explain.
Yeah, at the Bay Paul Center at the MBL, Mitch Sojin's lab, that they have looked at the effect of power plants and thermal contamination of water supplies. So if you have a power plant, it produces a lot of heat, and they need to dissipate the heat, so it usually goes into the waters around there. So you're driving on 195 and you go past Fall River, it looks like Three Mile Island, the mm-hmm. way those big towers are. So they're heating the water supplies there, which then goes into the bays. And so what they found is there's a complete change in the ecology of the water there, an increasing number of parasites and pathogenic bacteria. But the contamination, thermal contamination, is not chemical, but there's other changes that are going on in the water supply. And then when I go around the country and look at different areas and we talk about cancer incidences, it's very interesting. The coastal areas all have a higher incidence of cancer than a lot of the interior mm-hmm. areas, which I think is probably related to the water contamination, both from chemicals, things that in the septic systems or being flushed right. down the toilets, and also thermal effects.
All these, yeah, as you say, it's like, excuse me, a needle in a haystack, all these things impacting each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dr. Right. Brody, do you know much about that?
No, I hadn't yeah. known about the thermal contamination. Although when you have a discharge like that, there are going to be many things going on as was just described.
Yeah. So going forward, was it the studies that you've done here on the Cape, I'm assuming that's continuing, or are those studies done?
We are right now looking at drinking water quality, but we're worried looking forward. As I mentioned, the state legislature has not included new funding for the next fiscal year, so we're quite worried about whether we'll be able to continue this work, and hopeful that we can, hoping that state legislators will find a way to support this work so that we can continue to help advise Cape Cod communities about how to best protect the drinking water supply in the future.
It's really a whole public education thing going on here. As you were mentioning earlier, you know, we have this sandy soil, and you know, whatever we put into the ground ends up in the water at some point. So whether it's flushing it down our toilets or pouring it down the drain or what we use in our yard, so it's getting everybody to think about what we're putting into the ground, which ends up in our water.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Earlier, we mentioned age is one of the biggest risks for breast cancer. At what age do we start to see an increase of risk?
Well, the average age is 61 for breast cancer, and it's very uncommon under the age of 40. And once again, these genetic mutations really only are about 3%. 3 to 4% of all breast cancers are those inherited mutations. And then it starts to increase rapidly. So if you had 100 women in your high school class live to be 90, 12 would develop breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Just to put that in perspective, 100 men in your high school class, 13 or 14 would get prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. But once again, they're different. They're different cancers. And there's been a big push for more observation of prostate cancer. But right now, the jury's out on breast cancer, early detection or not. But we usually recommend mammograms at age 40 on an annual basis. A recent U.S. Preventive Treatment Task Force came out saying perhaps we should wait till age 50. But then there's this whole decade of women between 40 and 50 that we find with early stage breast cancer, which would be missed if they hadn't had mammograms. Mm. So I would still think that the American Cancer Society recommendations are annual.
Yeah. So would you do mammograms younger if perhaps it was a history? I mean, because there are some younger women. I had a cousin who had breast cancer in her 20s.
So you have the high risk group. And mammography, once again, under the age of 40, mammography is not very sensitive. We might do it, but we're not expecting to see a lot there. Mm-hmm. Ultrasound, whole breast ultrasound would be another way. But breast MRI is actually what we're doing for high risk population groups. So this would be a very high risk group. This may have been a woman that's had a biopsy showing atypical cells, not cancer, but atypical, or that has lobular carcinoma in situ, another type of precursor or a signpost that you're at risk for increased problems, or that you've had a BRCA mutation, you have not had your mastectomies yet. And then the MRIs would, for early detection, that could be every year on an MRI.
We have a caller who says that wants to remind us that breast tissue extends up to the collarbone.
That's right. It goes to the collarbone. It can go down to the ends of your ribs, goes to the side of your body. And that is one of the difficulties when a woman has a mastectomy. If she thinks a mastectomy is going to remove all the breast tissue, well, it removes an awful lot of it.
But
there still could be a little island of cells to the breastbone, up to the collarbone, or to the side of the chest.
All right. Dr. Peter Hopewood, cancer surgeon, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Julia Brody, executive director of Silent Spring Institute, who joined us from Boston. Thank you, Dr. Brody.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Margaret Carsley and John Parker for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.